Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Now, in my new guise as a crotchety middle-aged person, we've agreed that I would take the Free Speech Union of South Africa from the IRR and have created a separate company, a non-profit company. I feel very passionate about free speech and having as much of it as possible, irrespective of what people say and how they say it, horrible as it sometimes is, and informative as it can really be. So we will talk more about aspects of free speech in the coming weeks. But I really wanted, given the fact that I'm going to push and I'm going to look to doing some litigation, creating projects, particularly that involve debating at high schools and learning to express and listen to views that you don't agree with and don't hold. And I thought the best person to chat to about is actually my colleague. I still call him my colleague because I am still a fellow at the IRR. Michael Morris, welcome.
Thanks very much, Sarah. And I think, like you, it's a subject very close to my heart. I also feel equally as passionate about it as you do.
Well, I think I need to just tell listeners or remind listeners that you have spent many years in the media, and particularly with newspapers. So you will have covered the same sort of period that I would have lived through, which was growing up under apartheid, dealing with apartheid politically, watching apartheid end, watching much of the violence that preceded it going into the democracy. So from a media free speech point of view, you will have seen a great lack of it, followed by a great deal of it. Not perfect, but we do have a lot of it. Just give us a sense of your history through those two periods and why you've so committed to free speech.
Indeed. I mean, I think, you know, that history that you've also lived through, it does sharpen one's hunger for all the good things in a way. You know, the real meaning of freedom is, it's not, Richard Poplack once used a phrase that I was very fond of, actually in an interview with me. I interviewed him about a book he wrote about Julius Malema, and he said, you know, there's the one kind of freedom, which is the freedom to have ice cream for breakfast. And I think that's quite a nice way of putting the sort of flimsy idea of what freedom is. It's freedom, I want to wear pajamas all day, or you know, I want to have ice cream for breakfast. That's a sort of flimsy and you know, that's fine. It's your personal choice. We all for that. But the freedom is actually a difficult business. And it's, as you suggested in your preludial remarks, that it's quite a difficult one. It's taking on that burden of difficulty, that recognizing that the freedom that you want to choose for yourself to say something or to write about something or to expose something in society has its opposite in those who disagree with you violently and also want the same freedom. And it's a question of recognizing all those things and absorbing them in your daily work. I think it takes people generally. It could well be that I'm simply slow, but I think it takes a while. It takes a good while into your adulthood to fully absorb the complexities of all these things, these sort of quite basic liberal ideas. But they're quite difficult, and because they're difficult, you've got to kind of live through them and see how they play out and so on. But it does. The further you go, I think your convictions become stronger, and it enabled some, but not all, journalists, I think, who'd gone through the 80s to then go into the 90s and not shift a jot, recognizing immediately that they were simply dealing with another government, another source of power, you know, another, all the temptations that go with that. And there was no reason whatever to suspend vigilance or to think that nirvana had suddenly occurred. It hadn't. We'd simply transitioned from one kind of state of governance to another. So many of the social and economic problems were exactly the same, and the intellectual challenge remained the same. Dispassion, insisting on free speech, you know, being vigilant, making those claims constantly, resisting intrusions and so on. So, yeah, I think as a general sort of comment, that that describes, I suppose, my trajectory through that period. Yeah.
I think one of the things that one has to highlight, and is particularly pertinent in this country, and one was watching richer, securer, safer countries really almost degenerate in this regard with respect to the expression of free speech, is that for democracy to remain and to remain healthy, free speech underpins every right and obligation and law effectively that comes into existence. Michael, why is that?
Yeah, so I mean, it is the sort of classically challenging aspect of it. I was just looking at somebody who interests me quite a lot is Ira Glasser, who was the longtime head of the American Civil Liberties Union, 21 years from, I think, 1978 all the way through to 2001. So quite an interesting period in American history. I'm partly interested in him, I suppose. Well, I mean, just quite literally, just here's quite an interesting thing. I mean, being a Jewish man, he led this American Civil Liberties Union in the late 1970s in defending Nazis marching in Skokie in the United States, and for exactly the reason that is summed up in the headline of a very good piece he wrote just 2 years ago, January 2023, in Spiked. I highly recommend people go look for it. The headline is "Why We Must Fight for the Right to Hate," and it's that brings it down to the exactly where the challenge lies with free speech. It's beautifully expressed by Oliver Wendell Holmes, a U.S. Supreme Court judge of the 19th, relatively calls for attachment than the right to free speech, and not speech of those who agree with us, but thought that we hate. That's a very, very powerful thing. And of course, the reason, you know, it can't be said often enough that free speech is not, and I've made some notes here just to remind myself of some of these complexities, but, free speech is not to defend what is said that's constructive or kindly or respectful or useful or commonsensical. You know, generally, all those things can defend themselves perfectly well. The argument really must apply to speech that is repulsive and dangerous. This is always a tricky thing, because it's precisely those things that warrant exposure to light. They warrant challenging. They're a bit like bacteria. They thrive in dark, dingy places. I often say, you know, one of the reasons why you don't want to punish bad ideas by locking people up for them is precisely because that's where those ideas incubate and germinate and spread and become more and more vile. So bringing things to light, challenging in the open is absolutely vital. There's always this distinction between the content of free speech and the principle. So in the case of Glasser, you know, and there are a number of instances, very interesting ones, the American Civil Liberties Union, Skokie was one. They've defended people on both sides of the abortion debate. The National Rifle Association, you know, not an obvious friend of liberals in America, they defended their rights and so on. So they have demonstrated a pretty good record. Equally, of course, it's not uncontroversial. Glasser himself has attacked the current leader of the American Civil Liberties Union for what he thinks have been mistaken positions. Mm. That's also, I mean, that's really part of it. It's like demonstrating exactly what the principle is. So it's quite a wonderful thing.
Perhaps carry on, Michael.
Sorry, I'm going on a bit.
Sorry, Michael, your connectivity is just a little bit dicey, so. Just bear with us, and we'll see if we can get some clarity, or perhaps on your side. But one of the things I wanted to raise, and I'll do so in the meantime, is that South Africa has an extraordinary level of free speech. I think coming out of apartheid, we just went nuts, and no one can sort of interfere with our free speech. And not that at times the government hasn't wanted to shut down stuff, but it's really, it would a bit be like King Canute, you know, ordering the sea to reverse and go backwards. But they never stop trying. And the current example is exactly the sort of thing you're talking about, but except on a sort of slightly humorous level, in that Mac G, who is an incredibly successful podcaster, has over 1 million views, has 3 million YouTube subscribers. He's very hip and happening, for want of a better expression. And he interviewed a female celebrity, and South Africa loves its celebrities, and they're always fun to look at. But he basically made comments and asked questions about her breakup of a relationship using the most vulgar and all-round disgusting, horrible terminology. I mean, misogynistic would be a polite way and a simple way of describing what he did. But I guess, in a way, that's his shtick. He's a bit of a shock jock, and he's a lot of an idiot probably as well. But the problem is the right thing started to happen is that Women Against Abuse, which is an organization that deals with gender-based violence and similar issues, released a statement saying, you know, this was appalling and disgusting. And absolutely, and more of the society should pile in. But who piled in is Kuselo Diko, who runs the portfolio, the Parliamentary Committee on Communication. And she's articulate, very bright, and rather scary. And she started to hook into regulating podcasters. Now, there are some podcasters I'd rather hear less of, but podcasters and podcasting and social media is not like the legacy media. And as a consequence, it's, as has been found with all the other the big guys, the X's and the Facebooks, etc., they are very difficult to regulate because they don't actually perform the same function, but they get a lot of information, both useless and valuable, out there. And she thinks they should be regulated. So she has summoned MacG to a committee meeting to, explain himself. And I suppose after this meeting, he'll probably never say anything nasty again. But the point is, government is seeking to butt in, and it's likely to just end in tears. Why should government not be butting in? Leave it to the rest of us, I say.
Exactly. I mean, you know, banning speech or curbing speech in any way does more harm to social justice than any kind of regulation, you know, that would benefit it. And it really comes down to this key point. You know, you can't have an open, free society without people being free to be as open as they wish. And we're talking really about exchange between people, and whether it's exchange of ideas, exchange of goods, and even exchange of insults. You know, that is what an open society is. If you feel free enough and there aren't restraints that narrow your options, you're living in a free society. And you then actually have to also be responsible. Mm. You understand it's intuitive. You understand that you are now responsible in your reaction in forming the kind of society you want to live in. You've got to take part in it. There's no relying on a regulation or government or some heavy-handed agency stepping in on your behalf. And this is one of the points that Ira Glasser made about, you know, progressives in America, who would say, well, Don't you want to have equality and civil rights and so on? And he said it's precisely because we do that we insist on free speech, because you can only oppose the content if the principle is intact and you've protected the principle, and that's really the key thing. You know, none of us wants anti-Semitism, as Islamophobia, racism, whatever it might be, all these dreadful things, these pathologies that people find attractive in all sorts of perverse ways. The best way to fight them is to keep them in the light, hold them up, tackle them, never let them off the hook, and resist, you know, the temptations of governments or other agencies to step in on our behalf and try to protect us, because that is actually making us more vulnerable to those bad ideas.
Well, Women Against Abuse started it, and the way to deal with it is for those opposed, and particularly those who have audiences, whether they're written or oral, they have audiences to say things, to interview people. They could go to threaten to boycott his sponsors, but he, you know, other mechanisms such as fines or imprisonment would achieve nothing. And our real concern, obviously, and this goes to me and to you and the IRR, is at what point does such unacceptable speech, does the government decide, oh, we don't like criticism of our extensive BEE policies, just at a time when, in fact, there is a much greater discussion of the merits of, or rather the demerits of having BEE policies at all. Right. Now, obviously, it'd be attractive for the government to shut it down. But this is, if, you know, they could come for us next, or they could come for anyone who might make a claim that the government sees as controversial, but the society generally supports. That is ultimately, to my mind, the greatest potential threat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was listening into the closing section of your last segment of the show, where you were talking, you know, about the economy imploding, lack of investment, race, law, NHI. For this society to confront these things in a measured, material way requires us to have complete freedom to talk about it openly, share ideas, share options, alternatives, be able to set out why exactly we think the way we do. And without there being any sort of chilling effect, the minute you have that chilling effect, you're shutting down the agency of people in society. And that's really what makes societies effective, dynamic, buoyant, optimistic. It is that feeling that we are agents of our destiny. Mm. And for that, you need exactly, as you say, free speech and freedom of ideas. Absolutely crucial.
And sort of to give the government its due, and particularly perhaps the ANC over the last 30 years, is as a member of the International Free Speech Unions, which comprise mostly the Anglophone, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, where the free speech unions started, and Switzerland, particularly with academic freedom, is watching these democracies narrow free speech considerably. Some of it is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, it involves shutting down common sense, logical, fact-based information to counter the agendas of ideologies that don't stand up to scrutiny. And in a way, Free Speech Union South Africa is a bit of an outlier, because we're about just continuing to promote it, to call it out if it looks like it's being threatened, and to deal with it in positive ways, educate, etc. They're problem is they're spending all their time on litigation against government and crazy ideologues to shut it down. The irony is extraordinary.
It is indeed. And it also brings out, you know, the point that we often make is that there's no final destination that is arrived at, and you know, one then sort of sits down and takes a breather. The arguments for all these rights, but free speech especially, it's perennial, it's ongoing, it's unceasing. That vigilance is absolutely critical. Even, you know, the best of intentions, you've got to question them, test them, and so on.
Well, Michael, all I can say is viva free speech, viva, and thank you very, very much for joining me.